We are all welcome this morning, as every morning, dew and fog making acquaintance on the toes of our soggy boots, hair glistening with the abundances that the air could no longer hold. Rejoice that the world clings to our sleeves and arrives where we least expect it, for it is in the heart of the unexpected that we find understanding. We are one. Come, let us worship together. We are a Unitarian Universalist faith community. Each week we join thousands of others around the world in rekindling the steady flame of our shared faith as we light the chalice. In this precious time, we gather to gaze into each other, out at the vast galaxies, and into our own depths, that by knowing the source, we might make the fire stronger and yet not be consumed. We light this chalice to call us here into this room, into this community, into this sacred place and time. We are together in a raft on a fast-moving river these days, paddling and steering and leaning furiously, doing everything we can to keep ourselves in the boat and off the rocks and all together. Frankly, this congregation is doing really well. And we're stopping off this morning to bring another person on board, another guide who will help with everything from charting the course to learning new strokes. Sonia Taransky is our new director of Lifespan Religious Education and Exploration. She comes to us with a background that includes Aikido and seminary and parenting and teaching, and we are very, very glad to have you. Sonia, will you please come forward? A covenant is a series of promises that we make, each to the other, about the ways we will be together, about the things we will do and the things we will not do, about what we want and with and for each other. When we hire or call staff and clergy, we do so with the understanding that we will work together, and we make some promises about how we will do that. This is the time when we can make some promises with Sonia about how we want to act with each other as she helps us make classes and activities that will be fun and powerful, that will teach us about Unitarian Universalism, that will help us to ask questions, and that will help us to find answers. Sonia, why don't you stand here where people can see you? And will you begin, please?
Hi, I'm Sonia Taransky, and I'm really very pleased and honored to be here with you. As I begin this new position this year, I ask of you clear and honest communication that we might know each other's minds. I ask of you open dialogue that we might shape this program together. I ask of you guidance as I learn your community. I ask of you trust as I offer what I know. I ask of you support as I discover what I need and what you need. And I ask that we treat each other with respect and that our time together be sweet and fruitful. I promise that I will do my best to figure out, name, and support your wishes, your desires, and your needs. I promise that I will work in your best interest. I promise that I will try to balance learning and following and leading. I bring to you my broad vision, my ability to see a bigger picture, and my promise to serve with integrity.
And now will you all please rise and speak the words together as printed in your order of service. We welcome you, Sonia, to our church. While you are here, please help us help ourselves. Please care for all of us, the children, the youth, the adults. Please teach us what you know. Please learn from us about who we are. Please be honest with us. Please be gentle with us. We promise to listen to what you have to say. We promise to tell you what we think. We promise to share what we know. We promise to be respectful with you and with each other. We promise to try new things with open minds and willing hearts. And now let us say all together, we promise to work together for the best for each other. We promise to work together for the good of the church. We promise to work together for the good of the world. Thank you, and again, welcome. When we enter the church for the first time, we begin deciding if this place will feed our spirits, if this is a place where we could be made whole. The discernment for this is no less serious than for clergy entering the ministry, for each of us is choosing a spiritual path which we will need to choose again and again. Coming to church must be something each of us chooses each day and each week and each year. We may not know what we are choosing at first, but over time it becomes clear that the feeding, the making whole, comes only in part from what we receive. Deep spirituality means stepping into a circle of living, a cycle like water or nitrogen, a cycle of building up and breaking down, a cycle of giving and receiving, a cycle of balance. When we arrive, we are often bearing empty cups, and we fill and we drink, and we fill and we drink and we fill and we drink until we are full. Sometimes our stomachs get bloated and sloshy. This is natural. But sitting down, finally, cup full, belly sated, a little uncomfortable, we know there must be more. And so there is. See that person over there, cup dry? Give her some of yours. See that person offering drops from his nearly empty cup to everyone? Ask if he would like some help. And see her, the one whose one inch is filling every other cup to brimming? Follow her. She has been here longer than you or I. Perhaps we all can learn. It was just before the Passover feast. Jesus knew that the time had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love. The evening meal was being served, and the devil had already prompted Judas Iscariot, son of Simon, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. He came to Simon Peter, who said, "Lord, are you going to wash my feet?" Jesus replied, "You do not realize now what I am doing, but later you will understand." "No," said Peter, "you will never wash my feet." Jesus answered, "Unless I wash you, you have no part with me." "Then, Lord," Simon Peter replied, "not just my feet, but my hands and my head as well." Jesus answered, "A person who has had a bath needs only to wash his feet. His whole body is clean. And you are clean, though not every one of you." For he knew who was going to betray him, and that was why he said everyone was not clean. When he had finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. "Do you understand what I have done for you? You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you should also wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. I tell you the truth, no servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them." Here ends the reading. Do you want fries with that? Sometime while I was growing up, that upsell tagline from the world of fast food became emblematic of all that a failed education could be. "Do you want fries with that?" was the thing that college English majors and high school dropouts could expect, a life of low-level, thankless servitude as a result of bad choices made before we could have expected ourselves to understand what we were doing. "Do you want fries with that?" hung over our heads, greasy and cold and thick, just waiting for a chance to ooze down and ruin our lives. "Do you want fries with that?" was not a phrase we ever wanted by definition. Like smallpox and the cooties, it was contagious and insidious and disgusting. It tasted moldy and oily on our tongues, or so we were told. We never said it, ever, just in case it was really catching. What a horrible class lesson. What a ridiculous set of ideas. What on earth were my parents thinking? They weren't alone, of course. In my upper middle class New York suburban hometown, this was a story that many of us heard often. Our parents and teachers and guidance counselors told us fairy tales of what we could be if we were good kids, and what would happen if we disobeyed, and the McDonald's register became the modern equivalent of the dark forest populated by ogres in polyester uniforms who would enslave us forever. No one ever told me about McDonald's as a success story of American enterprise and inventiveness, or explained how franchises are a strong business model, or talked about pulling oneself up by the bootstraps by starting as cleanup crew and working up to manager and then regional supervisor. In the fantasy world painted by my parents, no one ever succeeded at fast food. It didn't help that fast food was known to be unhealthy food, food that was bad for our bodies and for our lives. It didn't help that we were the first wave of the sedentary and unhealthy generation, hemmed in by overscheduling and the threat of child molesters not to play in the street or out of sight lest we be whisked away by kidnappers with a strange vendetta against rebellious 10-year-olds. Further, McDonald's and its competitors represented a very suspicious thing. They represented pleasure. Unthinking pleasure, pleasure with no justification at all. It became a kind of underground possibility, a treat or a dirty secret between a grandparent or a babysitter and a child. No one was supposed to enjoy something just for the pleasure of it. So here we have cultural asceticism running up against excess on the one side. And on the other side, encouragement to excess, to lots of money and lots of power, if only we will stay away from seedy and seductive fast food service. To a 10-year-old whose parents work in suits, the uniforms are kind of cool. The idea of a job at all is thrilling. Working represents freedom and adulthood, not a lifetime of drudgery. Our guardians were only trying to do what was best for us, but in the process, they trained us to disrespect, misunderstand, and fear an entire set of possibilities. They closed the doors because they were so sure we didn't want what was behind them that they were afraid we'd wander in, get lost, and never come out. Some of what they said was true. It's easier to have choices about work when you have more education to a point. It's easier to have choices about life when you have money to a point. And working behind the counter in fast food, if you never get yourself promoted, doesn't usually pay enough to do more than just make it, if that. But that doesn't make the work less dignified. In a culture that claims to idolize hard work while spending millions on labor-saving devices, honest work for honest pay still has a basic value. Beyond that, service is a value that stretches across generational and cultural lines. When we give of ourselves to meet the needs of others, that helps to knit together the fabric of our lives. What we do in church is not all that different from what happens at Burger King or Hannaford when someone is buying food. There are people who have a need and people who help to meet that need. At some major big box stores, now they have self-checkout stations where customers can serve themselves, but lots of people still stand in line to have the help of someone trained and skilled. It's very much like hiring a director of lifespan religious education and exploration, or calling a minister, or going to a doctor, or consulting a lawyer who has training and skills to do something that you don't understand. People sometimes say that we have far more specialization than we used to in this world, that everyone used to be a generalist, but now there's too much information. I would offer that the specializations have shifted. Who here has a lady's maid? How about a footman? A haberdasher? Anyone? Most of these are dying arts, if not completely dead. Fortunately for some, butling, according to the schools that teach it, is no longer a dying art. Butlers are alive and well. Time was when every middle-class household had at least one servant, and many had more. But when the Industrial Revolution produced factories as an employment option, service was no longer the best of a limited set of choices. In manufacturing, the hours were fixed, and there was a good deal of freedom in controlling one's wardrobe and one's housing. For a while, it looked like servants were becoming a relic of the past. But then, slowly, those who could afford it started reinventing the concept of servant, working under modern standards for wages, housing, insurance, time off, and independence. The new butler is a very respectable executive position. He or she may be the only employee in a household or may manage a large household staff. They may be in charge of multiple properties, jets, yachts, and other accessories of life. They are almost certainly in charge of the wine cellar, butler having come from bottler, as well as household event planning, purchasing, budgeting, and probably scheduling. A well-trained butler also knows about security and bodyguarding, spit polishing shoes, answering doors, cleaning jewelry, and laundry stain removal. She or he is a specialist in the fine art of running a large estate and looking good doing it. In exchange, a butler can expect the respect of their employer, a very nice room and board on site, a robust benefits package including at least one day off a week and several weeks of vacation, and a salary between $50,000 and $150,000 annually. We could take some lessons. We all have people serving us every day, and we are all engaged in serving. There is nothing, nothing wrong with service, and one of the ways our society usually shows appreciation is through good compensation. Now, teachers, social workers, healthcare workers, cashiers, sales staff, burger flippers, clearly we've got a long way to go. But listen up. Thank you. We're all in this together. This work is valuable. This work has integrity. Whatever class-based nonsense has been spread around for at least the last 35 years, we've got to get rid of it together, and then we might be able to address the compensation issues. At root, it's about respect. We are all trained not to respect someone. It's ridiculous, but it's the way culture works. If your parents don't teach it, then your peers do, or the media does, and we fight it, but it gets in there somehow anyway, and we have to work to change the pattern. Because as long as we are divided by class as culture, we stand to lose too much to be motivated to dismantle the class system. Whether you're poor or rich, whether you're blue or white or pink collar, part of your identity comes from the class community with which you identify. It tells you how you speak, what you wear, how you celebrate holidays, where you shop, and how you think about and treat everyone else. It is a powerfully magnetic home base. And until we are mindful and graceful about the money and power differentials among us, we will be more comfortable in our old contexts and mindsets than we will be outside of them. In her book, Nickeled and Dimed, journalist Barbara Ehrenreich took 3 months, one in each of three American cities, to see if she could get an unskilled job, one that used none of her higher education or work experience, and make ends meet on the proceeds. Her investigation had her waitressing in Florida, cleaning homes in Portland, Maine, and working for Walmart in Minnesota. And her conclusion? No, she couldn't. My own experience was similar, working summers during college. The more of my skills I used, the better my chances of having any money left at all. After two holiday seasons in retail, which netted depressingly little, I discovered temp agencies and never looked back. The dignity afforded by the desk jobs was almost more important than the 20 to 50% pay raise I got by switching industries. At a temporary office job, I could negotiate for my salary. I could earn more with more skills. I could sit down. I could go to the bathroom on my own time. But more important, people trusted me. If I said something was wrong, my supervisor believed me and went about fixing it. If I left my desk to use the toilet, my employer took that as a natural consequence of having live employees. Unlike the retail establishments where I worked, there were no clear plastic break bags to carry lunches in, designed to prevent us from smuggling merchandise out with our tuna sandwiches. Who I was began to rise to importance, eventually pulling equal with what I could do. And with that change came treatment that honored the qualities for which I had been chosen. I could type fast, I could answer phones, but I was analytical, creative, pleasant, and that was what made me desirable. The companies and executives for whom I worked treated me as valuable. It was good for my self-esteem, but it also correlated with my understanding of ethical behavior. For the most part, moving into the corporate world softened the daily sense of righteous indignation that came from being treated as a high-functioning robot. Thanks, in part, to the incessant McDonald's lessons of my childhood, I thought it unlikely that this would become my permanent lot, but thanks to my Unitarian Universalist upbringing, I was indignant while working retail that anyone was treated this way, that any employer would take more than the time and attention the employee had intended to sell them. Service has a kind of embedded dignity which must be honored. Perhaps nothing is more telling than ancient folklore for that lesson. Almost all old stories have at least one moral. Look at the collections from the Grimm Brothers or the Blackfeet Nation or the fairy tales of ancient Scotland or Scandinavia, and there are morals floating nearly on the surface, easily skimmed off and held in memory. It's the nature of oral tradition that if there's no point telling a tale, someone will put one in or the story dies out. In a story I told last year about the origins of the Hindu goddess Kali, she has flown into a rage and cannot be stopped by anyone. The gods, including her consort Shiva, are in awe and terror, watching her prepare to destroy the world. Finally, in desperation, Shiva lies down where she is sure to step on him, and when her foot touches his chest, she realizes what she is doing, and she slowly calms down. Whenever I tell that story, I have to explain that in India, far more than here, the ground and the floor are considered dirty and debased places. Only the lowest ranking people in the room will sit on the floor. If a book touches the floor, you pick it up and touch it to your forehead as a sign of respect and remorse. When you greet an elder, you touch their feet, and for millennia, men have outranked women and husbands have outranked wives. So for a wife to place her foot on her husband or male consort's chest is almost unthinkable. That it happens at all in this story underscores how truly out of her mind she must have been, and how powerful Shiva's sacrifice was to lay down his dignity for the good of the world. It's a mind-blowing image within the culture that's repeated across the country in idols and paintings and temples, Shiva lying on the ground under Kali's upraised foot. On the one hand, it is a subtle dig at the entrenched cultural patriarchy as it puts something above a man's need for respect. But it also honors Shiva for making that choice, for knowing that the world was more important than even his own honor, and in some readings, taking responsibility for his partner's behavior. And why should he have that responsibility? Well, she's his, in ways we don't usually like to consider. But clearly, she's partly his because she chooses to be, because she's so powerful. So it's complicated. To me, the Western story most like this in terms of undercurrents and power choices is found in the Bible, chapter 13 in the book of John, which I used for this morning's reading. The book of John is the odd one out of the four Gospels. It starts in a different place and seems to have an entirely different goal in mind from the others. The language is less concrete. There's less correlation between it and the other three tellings of Jesus' life. As the scene opens, we are somewhere around the Last Supper, either during the meal or after it, and Judas has already gotten the idea of going to the authorities, but has not gone yet. Jesus gets up from the table, takes off his outer robes, girds himself with a towel over his short underrobes, and begins washing the feet of his disciples. Now, as for the story of Kali, we need background. In the ancient Middle East, people usually wore sandals in the street, as in India, and both sandals and feet got really very dirty in a day's walking. Not just dust, but dung and bodily fluids and rotten fruits. The streets were often a mess, and the feet, consequently, could really be disgusting. When guests arrived at a house, it was customary for the host to provide a slave or a servant to wash the guest's feet, or if none were available, water for the guests to wash their own feet. On occasion, wives also did this for husbands, children for parents, and students for teachers. In other words, foot washing went up the social hierarchy, not down. Feet and earth were dirty, and cleaning them was a sign of humility, or the work of a slave. If the washer were a slave, they would necessarily be Gentile, that is, non-Jewish, slave, and would ordinarily be clad in one short tunic. So as John tells it, Jesus was engaging in a little guerrilla theater. While everyone else still sat at the table, he stood up, took the clothing clothed himself as a slave, and began a task that even a Jewish slave would not be expected to perform. And remember, he was Jewish. If he had been concerned about clean feet, he could have washed his own feet and stayed dressed. But the evening meal was being served, and he elected to use his power to make a point. Some commentators elect to see him as lowering himself, but if we work within the Christian model and take as accepted the idea that Jesus purified, sanctified, and healed with a touch, then he himself cannot be defiled. Instead, as he performed service, he dignified and elevated it to practice and religion and ritual. He transformed it. He invested it with meaning and made the meaning retrievable by repetition and memory. In both cases, we have an old, an ancient story of a man god literally getting down on the ground in an effort to save the world. In neither case do they become triumphant heroes. Their dusty hands and dirty fingernails bear silent witness to their bold outside-the-box choice. In both cases, they set aside honor that their cultures could thrive, and in both cases, the metaphoric ripples have tsunami potential because both of them have set service above culturally constructed ideas of honor. By their actions, they point instead to the greater good, the higher ideal, which is the possibility of long-term change for the better. The story will come and go. One's reputation can be rebuilt. Definitions of honor can be changed. But the good of the world must be tended to now. We are all here to serve, and we will continue to fight our religious call, to wrestle with it, to struggle against it until we learn to honor it. What we must learn to honor is the service, the act, and the actors who are us. There is no shame in serving voluntarily or involuntarily when the end we are reaching for is noble and the means by which we reach are ethical. If we set service as a necessary evil or something below dignity, we lose our dignity ourselves, we lose trust, we lose faith in the goodwill of others, and that is the road to ruin. If we cannot trust on some level that there are those who give freely for giving's sake, and if we cannot trust ourselves to be some of those people, then we are paving the road to a life lived in isolation and fear. Instead, we must each shed our robes and gird ourselves with a towel. We must each find the world's dusty feet to clean, and we must lift up those who wipe the dust from our own tired heels. Not because the feet or the hands are or may one day be our own, not because there is some dank and desolate hell waiting, not even for some eternal afterlife in the great beyond. We must wash feet and we must honor those who do, because service is part of being human. It is part of who we are. It is part of how we have evolved. It is part of how we survive. It is part of our common life and, more important, part of our common pleasure. No long change for good ever came except by pursuing the pleasure it brought. The pleasure of giving rest to the weary, food to the hungry, drink to the parched, is the pleasure of meeting basic human need and relieving suffering. It is noble work. Perhaps the night shift at McDonald's won't change the world, but a lot of people come through those doors tired and hungry. Perhaps it will.